You are listening to the RTE Brainstorm podcast, proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Hi, my name is Ella McSweeney, and this is Brainstorm. If you want to know about new ideas from the world around you, then this is the podcast for you. The mental health of young people in Ireland has increasingly been a focus of concern, particularly since COVID, when demand for the child and adolescent mental health services increased by a third. Dr. Fiona Finn is the Youth Development Manager with Bodywise, and she's also affiliated with the Centre for Mental Health and Community Research at Maynooth University. Fiona, back in 2005, you worked with the National Suicide Research Foundation at school level, and you asked students what topics they would like to discuss. What did they tell you back then?
Well, some of the topics that they were particularly interested in were relationships and sexuality and body image. And body image was starting to come up more and more. And I suppose we were in the very early stages of people starting to use social media back then. And there's been a lot of changes, really, in the space of time since then.
I grew up, I was a teenager in the 1990s, and I remember at that time it would have been Kate Moss, Heroin Chic, would have been really formative for girls at that time. And I remember myself being very influenced by that idea that the ideal body shape was one that was very wasted away. That there was no social media then, but we were all clearly very receptive to those messages. So how much has it got to do with just the general media landscape, and how much has it got to do with social media in particular?
Well, I suppose that media messaging was always there, but to a much lesser extent. And actually, there's a very interesting quote that comes to mind from a book called Body Image in the Primary School. And it says that children in today would see more images of physical perfection in one day than their parents or their grandparents might have seen in their whole teenage years. And I suppose social media, what we are seeing now is that people are spending hours a day online, hours a day on social media. It really increases their exposure to these media ideals. So they're seeing them all the time. And really what I hear from young people is that they're seeing the same kind of images all the time. So it's that very slim, flawless look for girls often, and a very definite, muscular, flawless ideal for males as well. And, you know, what people say to me, what young people say to me is, I feel like that's how I should look, like this is how I'm supposed to look. And that it puts them under a lot of pressure, and that social media really gets them to comparing themselves and feeling very bad about themselves.
So it's in a kind of accelerant.
It absolutely is. It really kind of amplifies that effect. And I suppose the fact that they are on, they're seeing all these idealized images of physical perfection alongside pictures of their peers who are trying to emulate these ideals as well. And young people describe very real pressure to try and look like the images that they see, and taking 60 or 70 selfies, you know, to get the right one, and posting that, and then monitoring to see who has liked it or what people have said, or and that really impacting then on their overall well-being and on their body image.
What do we know, or what do you know, about the concerns and the awareness of body image and eating disorders, the link between the two?
There's a very strong link. So it's widely acknowledged in research that negative body image, is very strongly linked to some of the behaviours that would make a person much more likely to develop an eating disorder. So restrictive dieting behaviours, excessive exercise, and muscle building behaviours, and also to compare themselves to other people. Those kind of behaviours then might make a person much more at risk of developing an eating disorder.
So where you have high body awareness amongst young people and teenagers, that you would have an immediate concern that the red flag is there for potential eating disorders like bulimia, anorexia?
Absolutely, you know, and that's really what we're seeing. What we're seeing is an increase in the in body image concerns. We're seeing a prevalence, increased prevalence of body image concerns, you know, across all genders, and also, unfortunately, at a younger age than before. Research last year, so by the Ombudsman for Children in Ireland, found that 65% of young people indicated that body image concerns were impacting on their mental health. So, you know, that's very clear. And also towards the end of last year, we had research from the Health Research Board, 43% of, there's a 43% increase in the number of of hospitalizations for under 18s in the last 5 years. And we're seeing that across the board in Ireland. We're seeing a big increase in the number of boys and men affected by eating disorders. And we're also very worryingly seeing eating disorders starting at an earlier age. So it's not uncommon now to hear of young people in primary school developing eating disorders.
I suppose a lot of the mental health issues for adolescents seem from the research to sort of peak around 15 years of age, 15, 16 years of age. When we think about that period, I mean, is it starting earlier? We know that girls are getting their periods, for example, earlier and earlier. From your research, are you looking at adolescence as starting much younger than we think it starts, which is usually around 13?
Well, even so, the Psychological Association in America, you know, what they define as adolescence now, the early adolescence is 10 to 14. So there was a paper last year on social media harms in young people. And, you know, it touched a lot on the impact of social media on body image and on every aspect of youth well-being and mental health. And 10 to 14 was the age bracket that they define as young adolescence.
And with body image awareness, do you see a difference in how boys and girls react to the kind of images that they're fed through social media?
Well, I suppose in the past, people would have considered body image to be very much a female concern, whereas that really is no longer the case. So what we're seeing now is increasing numbers of boys and men affected by body image concerns and also eating disorders. And actually in the UK, over the last 5 years, there has been a 128% increase in the number of boys and men presenting for treatment for eating disorders. So that really, I suppose, gives us an indication. And while that's a UK statistic, we tend to be very much in line with the figures that they report. So, you know, I suppose the extremes, the ideas that we see in the media, they're very unrealistic and unattainable, but that's not the messaging. So the messaging really is that it's possible for everybody to look like this. And because people are so inundated and seeing the same kind of images all the time, they get the feeling that this is how I should look and that it's possible for me to look like that. And I suppose the advertisers as well want them to think that. So it's really about encouraging people to be insecure and, you know, using that insecurity as an opportunity for them to sell products. So, you know, if I feel unhappy with my skin, I'm more likely to buy that skin product. If I feel unhappy about my body shape and if I think that being a different body shape is possible for me by buying this product, then I'm more likely to buy it. And they really kind of capitalize on those insecurities. And I think it's really, really important when we're talking to young people about body image that we look at supporting them to be more media literate, to understand the media messaging, to be able to kind of see through that and realise that advertisers are trying to make them feel insecure so that they are more likely to buy their products.
And at the heart of it, are you talking about advertising in whatever form it appears? So be it social media, be it on adverts and TV, if the young people are still watching TV, is it advertising that really is at the heart of the, it's driving this kind of skewed version of what your body should look like?
Yeah, I suppose it is quite a big part of it. The media and social media, and, you know, I suppose all the advertising now is on social media as well, isn't it? You know, and the research that I've been carrying out over the last number of years in collaboration with Maynooth University and also funded by the Irish Research Council. And I had some supervisors in Maynooth as well, Professor Sinead McGilloway and Dr. Katrina O'Toole. And we did kind of a multi-stage research project to develop a school-based program to promote positive body image. And it's really important, if you're doing something like that, that you really listen to what young people have to say. Because, you know, I didn't grow up with social media. Things have changed so much. And it's really important that we listen to how young people experience these pressures around body image. Where do they feel these pressures are coming from? What aspects put them under the most pressure? And how do they think we can effectively challenge those pressures? So a big part of the project and the programme that we have developed to promote positive body image is also looks at promoting social media literacy to encourage young people to be able to critically examine the messaging from the media, to be able to identify, you know, the motivations behind those posts, whether it's from an organization or from, or whether it's from a friend or a person, and to be able to really deconstruct that so that it has a less of a negative impact on them, and also to support them to be able to kind of curate their social media feed and the way that they interact with social media so that they realize, you know, what's having a negative impact on them. This is really making me feel bad about myself. I don't need to see this all the time, and how to kind of curate their social media feed so that they start to follow things that make them feel good.
So putting a space between themselves and the messages that are coming at them.
Absolutely.
How receptive are they at that age to that?
Well, you know, I suppose the way to be, to ensure that they are receptive, is to work very closely with young people in developing the content. So that's really what I do, you know, and it takes a lot of different stages. So, you know, we might have a focus group, a number of different focus groups, and then based on those focus groups, and focus groups are always youth led. So I'm there, all right, as a facilitator, as the lead researcher, and I would have a co-facilitator, but really it's just about to getting the ball rolling and get the young people talking amongst themselves so that they really kind of give you a clear insight into what the pressures are. And then once you have that information, then we would go away based on what they've told us they want to see, and develop content. But then that content will also have to be reviewed by a number of different independent youth panels, to establish whether it is actually relevant or engaging. And sometimes you go back and they say, no. And it's not, you know, they don't think it's any good, and you have to go back to the drawing board. But if you don't do that, you're going to go into schools with a program that isn't effective, you know. And we've been very, very lucky in that I've collaborated closely with teachers, young people, and mental health professionals. And the end result was that the program was really well received and had positive effects in males and females.
So. And what kind of interventions does the program offer then? I mean, is it more about young people not seeing stuff than seeing positive images of body and all the rest? Is it more about making sure that they don't have access to certain types of social media? Or can you balance that access with, you know, kind of positive body image messages from various people?
I think it's really about empowering young people. You know, I think they are so clever. Like every focus group that I do with young people, I'm kind of blown away by how much they know, and that really they are the experts on matters that affect them. And really, if we're going to kind of move forward at all on this area, we really, really need to listen, not just pay lip service to, or not just kind of tokenistic collaboration with young people, but to actually really, really listen and to work and move forward hand in hand with them, because there are positives to social media as well. You know, I suppose they have at their fingertips access to lots of information that we wouldn't have had when we were growing up, that I certainly wouldn't have had. And the opportunity to, it's interesting how many different tools for well-being there are online as well. But it's really about empowering young people to, and they, if they are invited to collaborate, and given the opportunity to be experts on the area, will absolutely step up to the mark and give really kind of good insight. So we worked really closely with young people on developing the More Than a Selfie program, and the feedback on it was that all of the participants involved, so over 90% of the participants indicated that they felt the program was valuable, and almost 90% across all of the different schools said that they would recommend the program to a younger friend or sibling. So that's kind of amazing, really.
So the selfie program, how does it work, and what within it is the most effective way to help young people?
So the More Than a Selfie program was developed in collaboration with young people, teachers, and mental health professionals, and key decision makers, so policy makers, and they were all involved as key stakeholders at the outset. And young people then were involved throughout. At every single stage, they were involved. So we went away, we put together video content. Like what they said was, yes, we really need a program in schools that supports young people to develop social media literacy, that improves body image, and that promotes awareness of the link between having negative body image and mental health and eating disorders. So I work with Bodywise. Bodywise are the national organisation that support people with eating disorders in their recovery. So it was really important that we include that component. So what we know is that there's a huge increase in eating disorders, and it was very important that there was a component on that as well. So the resulting programme has a range of different videos. And the reason for including videos was that we wanted the programme to be able to be very easily delivered by teachers nationwide without any training. So we wanted them to be able to just take this programme and run it. So there are lots of different videos. There are videos by young people for young people about body image, about different kind of pressures, about social media pressure, about the impact of social media on mood, and very kind of honest conversations and videos. And the idea is that with the videos and group discussion and some pointers. So there are four different lesson plans. The first two are around body image, the media and social media. The third one is around identity and fitting in. And then the fourth one is around body image and mental health, and includes videos by me actually delivered talking about eating disorders. And it was delivered, put together in this way to really kind of take the onus off teachers to have kind of specialist knowledge, because that's not fair. So it's very, very easy to use. The videos are embedded in a very easy to use format. Teachers have a facilitator's guide, but they really only need to put on the videos, play, get the students into small groups, get them to discuss the topics that have come up in the videos, and then move on, you know, so they don't really need to have any additional knowledge themselves.
And the interventions for boys and girls, I mean, do the same interventions work? I know in the past that sometimes it's been shown that boys aren't too receptive to certain interventions in a way that girls might be. But in your experience, were they the same ones?
Yeah, and I suppose that absolutely, you know, you're right. There has been a gap in the literature in that area. So there are very few school-based interventions to promote positive body image, which also include a focus on social media literacy. So the More Than a Selfie programme is one of just a few worldwide. The other programmes prior to the More Than a Selfie programme saw some improvement in terms of body image in girls, but not boys. And in fact, some of them saw a disimprovement in boys who participated. And the authors indicated that they showed some muscular bodies as part of the intervention, and that this may have inadvertently promoted the muscular idea. So they indicated that. Now, the More Than a Selfie programme, we saw a change in both males and females. So we were really pleased with that outcome. And in fact, we saw greater change in boys than girls in our programme. And the programme was designed for use with first-year students. And that target age was decided based on a review of the literature and based on the feedback from the key stakeholders who are involved, so teachers and mental health professionals in Ireland, and also from the young people as well. So I suppose the fact that it worked so well with that age group, and that we saw a change in males and females, I suppose emphasises that, you know, or indicates that it probably was the right age group, that they were receptive at that age. Now, we were also really, really careful to include video content of young males talking about body image as well. And I think that was really the clincher. That was really, you know, that. And
so that kind of peer-to-peer really works.
Really works. And really listening to what they wanted in terms of video content, and making sure that we went through all of those different stages and reviewed the video content with different youth panels, and only included the content that the young people all approved. So, as I said, we had some videos that were put together, and it's all very time consuming doing that. But even so, if they said no, we just didn't include them, and we moved on and we went back to the drawing board.
I suppose it asks a fundamental question, which I know we've in Ireland have been grappling with, and you know, the ministers have got involved in this discussion somewhat, which is really, should young people have any access to social media at all? Are we trying to fight an onslaught? What's your sense coming out of your research? I mean, would those kids be much better served by just not having access either to smartphones in particular, in totality rather, or social media in particular?
Well, it's not really possible to say that, because we do have social media. So I suppose we can't really, you know, you can't really approach it in that way. They have social media now. And, you know, one of the really important aspects of adolescent development is the connection with their peers. You know, and now that is through social media. So, you know, it's not possible for us to just take it away, or it's not possible for me to say, if they didn't have it, you know, what would things be like?
I mean, there is an argument, isn't there, that really the cutoff should be 16 years of age, and that actually if we waited until kids were 16, they'd be much more resilient and robust,
yeah,
and much more able to manage it. From your research, would you think that that would be very beneficial for their mental health?
I think it, in an ideal world, it would be great. I think in an ideal world, it would be great. And, you know, in Australia, for example, they have brought in that ban, you know, for that social media isn't, you know, a ban for under 16s using social media. And it will be brought in the next 12 months. It seems very reactive. Like, social media is here. Yes, there's no doubt about it. It's having a negative impact in terms of mental health. But bringing in a ban when young people maybe have been so used to connecting with each other in that way, I don't know if that's the answer. I think what would be much more helpful would be to have a meaningful collaboration with young people to find an alternative way, to talk to young people and say, look, this is really impacting on your mental health. This is the research. This is what we're seeing in terms of not just body image, but in terms of self-harm, in terms of suicidal behaviours. This is a real concern. These are your peers. We know you're worried about this too. What would you do? You know, what is the pathway forward? Because with a ban, with any kind of ban, people will find a way around it. They will start to put in false ages. You can, you know, access it a different way. You know, I've been reading about it, and they've brought in similar bans elsewhere, and a person can just set up an account that makes it look like they're from outside the country, and they can, you know, and young people will find a way around that. So it needs to be a pathway forward that's developed in collaboration with young people, because it affects them more than anybody else.
And what would be your message for the tech companies with regards to the power of the algorithm itself? Because at the end of the day here, we are talking about the power of the algorithm on these various social media apps and how they can change the way young people feel about themselves.
And that, I suppose, that is really where there's room for change. You know, the algorithm it's so powerful. The tech companies absolutely know, you know, they have the technology to know who is logging on, whether it's male or female, what age they are, because we know, we can see that if it's a child of 10, you know, they are being targeted with products like beauty products or different things, even at that age. So they know what age the person is. They're able to tell that. So there needs to be negotiation with the tech companies to ensure that the safeguarding of youth mental health, and to ensure that the algorithm is used to divert unsafe content and marketing and advertising of products that are capitalising on a person's insecurity away from children. So absolutely, that needs to happen. Absolutely. So those conversations, I think, are really, really important. But I think bringing in a ban, I think there needs to be a lot more conversation before we would go down that road to make sure that it's done in a way that's actually going to make a difference. Because I think just bringing in a ban, you know, if young people have been able to communicate with each other in this forum for a while, and then all of a sudden you stop that, you know, without an adequate plan, that doesn't make sense to me.
What's your advice to young people listening who may be struggling with their use of social media, may understand as they do so, well, this isn't making me feel too good, but I can't quite step away from it? I mean, that's a familiar feeling for all of us, not just young people. But what's your advice to them?
Really important that they listen to those feelings. I think if they're feeling like that and they're noticing that social media is having a negative impact, it's really important, first of all, that they tune in when they're on social media and they start to notice how they feel when they see a particular post. They start to kind of tune in and see what posts make them feel good about themselves and maybe what makes them feel bad about themselves. And I would suggest that if anything kind of makes them feel bad about themselves or less happy with who they are, to really kind of start to tune into that. To try to make steps to unfollow or mute content that makes them feel bad, to actively curate their social media feed so that it makes them feel good good about themselves. And I do think it's really important that they would talk about it as well, so that they would maybe talk to their friends about it. You know, what's really been interesting for me in focus groups over the years is that once young people start to talk to each other about social media pressure, they realise that they are all experiencing the same pressure. And one of the very interesting things that has happened in all of our focus groups is that while social media pressure has tended to dominate the conversations in every focus group I've had, at the end, after the young people talked about social media and talked about the pressures they were experiencing, they all seemed an awful lot lighter, and they all then started to kind of talk about what can we do to lessen this pressure, how can we stop focusing on what other people like, you know, and start to focus instead on doing things that we like and supporting each other to follow and pursue things in our own lives that make us feel good, you know, and to work together to pursue things that and support each other, I suppose, to lessen social media pressure, and to find ways to support each other to pursue their individual interests.
Well, I just think about the food industry, for example. You know, we always talk about our grandparents' time, but it is so rapidly changed in the last 50 years. Food is available 24/7. It's available a click of a button. There's a lot more products available and a lot more products tailored to, for example, young men who want to eat lots of protein and think that that'll help them get more muscly and all the rest. It's certainly something that is targeting younger people. And it is very available. I just wonder if there's anything in that space that you see as difficult for young people to manage.
Well, definitely the information around protein and high protein foods, that would be a huge source of pressure. And one of the things that we would hear a lot about as well is people using kind of food apps and, you know, food tracking apps and fitness tracking apps, and they would actually be a big risk factor for somebody developing an eating disorder. So somebody kind of getting caught up and just following the numbers and then becoming kind of disconnected from how their body feels, and it can kind of encourage obsessive behaviours around food and exercise that can then make a person much more likely to develop an eating disorder. And again, I think, you know, the same as with the other areas, it's really around promoting awareness and educating people around finding ways to move away from the things that are not having a good impact and move towards the things that are making them feel better. And you know, and it all makes sense if you think about it and you talk about it. But until somebody tells you, it doesn't make sense, you know. So I suppose it's really around promoting awareness. It's really around promoting media and social media literacy and encouraging people to be able to kind of navigate that space with a critical mindset and to realise that most of the stuff that we see online is not real. Most of the images that we see are edited, and those people don't really look like that. They probably don't take those products. And it's really around, you know, and that's what we do in our schools program. So as part of the More Than Selfie program, we really talk about those things. We talk about the fact that these people that we see in the media, they don't look like that in real life. And they don't use these products, and that advertisers are using these techniques to make, first of all, make you feel insecure, make you think, oh, here's the answer, to encourage you to buy their product. And what they also do, I suppose, the media messaging, there's so much emphasis, and we've talked about this earlier, on appearance. And, you know, these ideas that we see, the very slim look for girls, the very muscular look for guys, they don't just tie it to how you look. They make it seem like if you look like this, you're going to be successful, you're going to find love, everything in your life is going to work out. So it's tied to a much bigger picture. So it's very easy if people are online and they're inundated with this messaging around this is the ideal body shape, and if you look like this, you'll also have all these other brilliant lifestyle things. It's so seductive, isn't it? And people start to buy into that. So it's encouraging them to be able to step out of that and be able to realise, no, this is nonsense, and they want me to believe all this stuff so that I will buy their products. And part of our programme, and one of the things that has worked in other programmes that have, you know, seen positive results and that's been identified in research as well, is encouraging people to actively speak out against the media ideas. So it's called a cognitive dissonance programme, so where they speak out against these and they reject these media ideas. And when they do that in the peer setting, in the school setting, that's really, really powerful, you know. And then you get them kind of talking about, okay, and getting annoyed maybe about, why am I spending so much time focusing on what other people like? Why am I spending so much time noticing what other people like, what other people follow, when I'm not spending time doing things that I like in my own life? And how can I take that power back?
It's a lot to ask of kids, isn't it? I mean, I'm just thinking about my own adolescence, and I didn't have any of this landscape to navigate. Yeah. the very period where you want and need and you're biologically driven mm-hmm. to be the same, yeah. to not be different.
Yes.
Is the one stage now that we are asking adolescents, no, not only do you have to step outside of that, you have to rail against it. Mm-hmm. It's a huge amount to ask. I mean, I just wonder, is it not just easier to say, let's just not have it?
And wouldn't it be great in a way, you know? And it did seem like I grew up long before social media, and you know, it's lovely to look back and kind of think, oh, it was so much simpler. And I think it was simpler in a lot of ways, but the world maybe has moved on. So, you know,
I think that adolescence is hard. I mean, my adolescence was hard.
Mine was too. Yeah.
But is it not just too much to ask of kids, especially when they're dealing with the algorithm? I'm just wondering, for example, you mentioned Australia mm-hmm. and this ban will come in for under 16s. Yeah. Do you expect now in the next few years to see that their rates of eating disorders will reduce?
I do. You know, but I think it needs to be done right. Like, I would absolutely love it. I have two children as well. I would love if they weren't on social media until they were 16. I do think it has brought a whole raft of issues at a younger and younger age. You know, like, unfortunately, what we know is, you know, so we know that the minimum age for, at the moment in Ireland, for social media, minimum age is 13, say for TikTok or Instagram or Snapchat. You're supposed to be 13 to be on those. Now, what we also know is that there are a lot of people who are much younger than that who are on all of those. So CyberSafe Kids have done research that has indicated that 68% of 8 to 12 year olds have a social media presence. 68%. And that they're online and on social media for hours every day. And they're exposed to all of this really adult content, and they're exposed to these media beauty ideas from a really young age. And of course, that goes in, you know, and it's that messaging is going in all the time. So absolutely, it would be amazing if there was that ban. But I do really feel that it needs to be done right, and it really needs to be done. And there is talk about them bringing it in the UK. And if they do that in the UK, you know,
we'll probably follow.
We probably will follow as well. But I do think it really needs to be done in collaboration with young people. It can't be just, OK, we're doing this, we're taking this away, because we do need to also acknowledge that there are lots of positives to social media, and how can we make it a safe space? And it is about talking to tech companies about the algorithms, and it is also about really talking to young people and listening and learning what the pressures are, how can we support them and what do they need instead? We can't just take it away and give them nothing else. So they need to be able to connect with each other. So there's a lot of other questions that need to be answered. I absolutely think it will be amazing, but I don't think you can just pull the rug out and not have anything else. Otherwise, people will find a way around it.
Dr. Margaret McClafferty is a research fellow in mental health at Ulster University. Margaret, you have looked in your professional career at the mental health issues of college students. I just wonder what range that you're dealing with.
So a lot of my research to date has been focusing on university students. And we conducted a number of different studies as part initially of the World Mental Health International College Student Initiative led by Harvard. And the age group that we would have been focusing on was, you know, from 18 upwards. The majority of our students would have been in the age range 18 to maybe 21. But we obviously had a lot of mature students as well. And in our initial studies, we were looking at students that were just commencing college, but we then were able to do longitudinal studies with them, looking at the trajectory of their mental health and well-being across the time that they were at university. We were finding, though, that people tend to think students, when they're in university, suddenly, you know, get mental health problems. But what we were finding in our studies was that students were actually coming into university with pre-existing problems. The first study that we conducted in Ulster University was called the Student Wellbeing Study. And we did that back in 2015. And we were really, really shocked at the prevalence rates of mental health problems among students starting college for the first time. We use clinically relevant questionnaires, and approximately a quarter of students were screening for depression, lifetime depression, and about a fifth were screening for anxiety disorders. But the big thing that really stood out to us was the amount of suicidal behaviour. Absolutely shocking rates. Roughly around 20% were saying that they'd had a suicide plan or that they had self-harmed in the past, and 7.7% had attempted suicide prior to starting university. So this made us start to think, you know, that obviously there's something going on, you know, before they start. It's not necessarily when they're there. Okay, that a whole transition to college can really exacerbate problems for a lot of people. But we've started to look now at secondary school students. And I was very fortunate last year, I received a grant from the Pathways Programme. So this is now through Research Ireland to conduct a 4-year study known as UL. And it's looking at student mental health and wellbeing across the island of Ireland. And we are looking at university students, but we're also looking at secondary school students and looking really, I suppose, to see what we can do to help students in that year or so prior to starting university and also in the whole transition to university.
Mm-hmm. And you spoke about the data there, and it is, as you say, shocking. How does it compare to years or decades beforehand?
Well, they do. I mean, it seems to be increasing year on year nearly. And now, I mentioned the World Mental Health International College Student Initiative. The data is quite similar across, you know, across the world. It's not just here. Although the Northern Ireland study had some of the highest rates of mental health problems in any of the participating universities. What I would say is that the Ulster University study was the only survey that was conducted in either Ireland or the UK. So while we could compare our rates with, say, France or Australia or America, we couldn't actually compare. There was nothing really similar locally, nationally. Now, there are surveys out there that are looking at, say, for example, students that are accessing services. But what we wanted to really look at was the general student population. So we've, in the new study, part of it is that we're really trying to establish a network of like-minded people, you know, anybody interested in student mental health and well-being across the island of Ireland. And we really want to try and get some sort of standardised measure utilised by universities so that we can get a clear picture of exactly where we are standing in terms of mental health and well-being of the student population.
And what is it about the student population that you're particularly interested in and the sort of educational system? So we have primary school, and then we have often this big shift into secondary school at a very difficult time when you're entering adolescence, and then going on into another institution if you decide to do that and go into college. Why aren't you just looking at the age groups, the general cohorts in society, as opposed to particularly looking at the educational system?
As I mentioned, I suppose you have the likes of the My World survey that are looking at the general population. I suppose our interest really is around the whole transition. Like you mentioned, all these transitions from primary school into secondary school, into the university. Any type of, you know, transition can be really, really stressful. And like we're finding in general that the student population do seem to be really susceptible to having mental health problems. And I think I mean, yes, we can go and out into the general population, but it's, I suppose, somewhat easier in some ways to track people, you know, through the university system and, you know, through the various institutions. And to the idea behind it is it's not just about, you know, tracking their mental health and their well-being. It's looking at, you know, with an active audience there, how can we help them? Like, what sort of early interventions can be put in place to maybe help these young people during the transition into college and out in then out into the real world?
A lot of mental health problems appear certainly to start around 15 or 16 years of age.
Yes.
And we know that that is the height of adolescence, of hormonal and neurological changes in our bodies. And for a lot of people, it is just a tricky time. It's not necessarily that you're suffering from a mental health problem. It's just a very Exactly. difficult time when you're changing so rapidly. How do you distinguish between the difficulty of adolescence and something that is a serious mental health problem that needs addressing?
Yeah, well, as I think the aim, I suppose, when we're looking at this is, I think it's really important not to over medicalize things. And as you say, like, a lot of people, you know, are in distress, but they don't necessarily, you know, have clinically relevant problems. So it's really about tackling any sort of distress early on. As you say, 15, 16, really, really prevalent times for a lot of mental health problems to emerge. I mean, within our studies, we certainly found that to be the case, that the age of onset was around these ages. An interesting fact, though, that we found in our studies was actually that the age of onset seemed to be younger in students that were in the Republic of Ireland as opposed to those in Northern Ireland. Now, again, I mentioned that we were only talking about a few universities, which, again, is why we really want to get out and to, you know, look at colleges involved right across the island of Ireland. But again, it's going back to...
I mean, do you have any theories as to why that is? It's fascinating, the idea that young people from the Republic are showing signs of mental health problems earlier than those in Northern Ireland.
I suppose one of the theories that we had, I mean, I've worked in Northern Ireland. I live in the Republic of Ireland. I have children that have gone through school in the Republic of Ireland. I suppose one of the theories that we really want to investigate is around the schooling system. What we find really interesting was that while I'm saying, you know, the age of onset in the Republic was at a younger age, but when these students, we followed them across their time in university, the students that had gone through the education system in the Republic actually did a lot better in terms of their mental health and well-being throughout their time at university. So one of the things that we've been looking at, and this is why we really want to go back into secondary school students in our research, is it something to do with the educational system, the leaving certificate versus A-levels, for example? Now, I know through a lot of work that has gone on in the UK, they would say that students that are doing A-levels are nearly spoon-fed a little bit more. So then whenever they go to university, they tend to struggle a lot more, we think, than the students that have possibly done the Leaving Cert that's not necessarily as spoon-fed as the A-levels, if that makes sense. So that's like one of the things that we're looking at. Another factor within our studies was socioeconomic status seems to be a big factor as well. One of the colleges that we were looking at was an Institute of Technology at the time and had one of the lowest levels of socioeconomic status, you know, in the country. So that could be a factor as well. So there's a lot of things that we need to take into consideration, which is, again, why we want to have a more standardized type of survey that we can get a better understanding of mental health and well-being.
Makes complete sense, doesn't it? Yeah, it makes complete sense. I mean, if you're looking at financial inequality and things like the housing crisis in the student population, those who are don't have as much money as others and don't have a kind of more economically stable situation, they are certainly more vulnerable to mental health problems. Yeah.
Definitely, definitely. And I mean, a big thing that seems to be coming across, I mean, I know from talking to, you know, members of our research network that are doing some work on students that are commuting. I mean, more and more students are commuting rather than living away from home. And some of them are traveling for a really long period of time, basically because of the lack of availability of accommodation close to campuses. And this seems to be having a really negative impact on the student in terms of their mental health and well-being. And a big thing that, you know, we would look at within our research, I mean, it's not all about depression and anxiety and things. Like what we're trying to look at, you know, is well-being in general. And a big factor that seems to be a huge risk factor for young people in general, I mean, not just students, is loneliness and social isolation. So, I mean, if you're traveling a long time to get to and from university, and you're not really engaging in, you know, the traditional university setting, you're not getting, you know, a chance to meet people and have what, you know, I'd have called in my day the normal, you know, university life of the socializing involved with it. And I think that's such a shame.
I mean, what you're highlighting are more societal questions about general inequality, which would affect everyone, wouldn't it?
Exactly. Yes. Yes.
The question about adulthood, I mean, I'm always interested in the idea that you're obviously legally 18, you turn into an adult and you can drink alcohol and you can vote and all the rest. But from a neurological point of view, the brain shows that it matures well into our 20s. So at the point where people are leaving college could well be the point at which they're fully emerging from adolescence. And yet we label 18-year-olds potentially right in the thick of adolescence as being adults. Do you think this has any impact in terms of how they are able to manage difficulties and understand their difficulties as well?
A big thing that I would kind of be thinking on, you know, is around the whole coping strategies and you know, the building of resilience, etc. I mean, that is something that is learned, you know, throughout the years. And it seems to be something, again, looking at the research, it seems to be something that is getting pushed out further and further in some ways. Like I was reading an article just last night. I mean, there's a lot of talk going on about resilience. Again, it was and resilience building among young people. And we as parents, I suppose, need to take some responsibility for that too. And, you know, a lot of parents are trying to protect their children and, you know, trying to, I suppose, give them as much as they can. But the thing is that overly helping the person to become that adult that you're talking about? And social media, again, is getting a lot of airplay at the minute in terms of, you know, the developmental stages and what we would class as, you know, this whole social integration and things.
I mean, I just wonder whether, I suppose it goes back to that point of distinguishing between real mental health problems and the kind of typical difficulties of adolescence that appear certainly neurologically to continue into our early 20s. I mean, I know that some mental health experts have increasingly been suggesting that that question of resilience needs to be brought in a lot more, and that if young people aren't resilient enough, they lack the capacity to withstand the kind of difficulties that everyone faces. I just wonder what you think about that. I mean, some people would say, particularly in secondary schools, that we are talking too much about mental health and that it's leading to kids to overinterpret their symptoms and see themselves as more troubled than they are. And we've got this University of Oxford research coining the term prevalence inflation, which is basically saying that we are reporting mild, typical symptoms of adolescents as significant mental health disorders. Is that something that you take into account with your research?
Yeah, I mean, like, definitely so. It is about normalizing. I mean, there is that big push into getting people to, you know, recognize, you know, mental health symptoms. But again, it's not over medicalizing things, and it's trying to normalize and getting them to recognize, you know, that the signs and symptoms, and just, I suppose, really trying to address the issue before it does become a problem. I mean, in our research, we've actually been collaborating with MD Educational Foundation. Now, they're a charity that are prioritising, I suppose, student mental health and well-being. They've just started off here. It was running for a number of years in the UK, but they have schools now in Ireland and in Northern Ireland where they're actually putting in like well-being leads into secondary schools to help promote positive well-being, like through the delivery of well-being curriculum, by actually trying to normalize psychological fitness and resilience and helping to you know, enrich well-being. Like, that's just one example, but I think it's something, you know, that a lot of schools could take on board. I know from the work that we're doing, that there's a lot of schools that have well-being staff members, now maybe a teacher, but again, it's all about trying to, you know, normalize things, and about, you know, trying to get people to talk about any sort of mental health issues, so that they can recognize the symptoms in themselves and in their friends. But again, just about the big thing, the big message to me is about, if you do have a problem, that there is somebody that you can reach out to, and that you know where you may be able to get help. From our research, we found, like, a lot of people don't want to necessarily get help because they're still afraid of the stigma around mental health issues. So it's educating people at an early age and trying to identify early interventions that might help them. Now, it doesn't have to be now, like, be it in the secondary school or in the university. It's not all about, you know, counselling services. I'm not saying everybody needs to go to a counselling service, but it's just recognising, you know, that there's different things that could be there to help support people. I mean, like, we found from our work that peer support programmes or any sort of, like, social interactions are really, really beneficial. Within my own university, I'm at ATU Donegal. For example, they have developed, like, wellness cafes where, you know, there's peer support, student unions are involved, etc. But it's just, it's kind of bringing people together to talk about mental health and to try to destigmatize it all.
And how,
again,
important,
looking for alternative interventions.
You've mentioned loneliness. You've mentioned also things like the housing crisis. I just wonder, you know, mental health, I suppose you can obviously clearly look at it as an individual issue. But do you think we need to take a much broader societal, economic and political perspective to understand mental distress? I mean, for example, if the housing crisis was sorted, how much difference would you see amongst the college students that you're talking to in terms of their mental distress?
I mean, it's hard to gauge, but I mean, it certainly seems to be something that is causing an awful lot of distress to students. I mean, the fact, like I've mentioned earlier, you know, the fact that, you know, if you're living away quite, you know, if you're living at home or if you're living a long distance from your college, then it can be really difficult for you to get that full, you know, college experience in terms of meeting other people, meeting your peers and having, you know, that college experience. You also have, you know, it's not just obviously about the college experience, but like if you're traveling for long periods of time, within our own college, for example, it was noticed, you know, that a lot of students were arriving on campus really early, sitting in their cars, because they were trying to, you know, avoid traffic, you know, coming into campus to get there on time.
So they're sleep deprived.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, like if you're traveling 2 or 3 hours on top of your normal college day, you know, it's going to take an awful lot out of you. And you also have to consider that, like, the majority of students are also working on top of doing their normal college work, you know, so they don't have much time. It's going to take, you know, it's going to be a strain on them in general.
Do you think that there would be any value in having some sort of minimum age limit for people who go into college, given the fact that we know how tricky adolescence is? The idea, I mean, you know, I went to college very young. I have friends who were 17, rather, going into college as well. It seems very young to be put into that kind of situation. I just wonder, are we missing a trick here in setting the age just a little bit higher so that people can have a better experience and be more able to tackle the kind of challenges that college brings, but also the great times and the advantages that they can get from it too?
I don't know. I mean, like, I don't think, you know, I get what you're saying, but do you know, like, I think the majority of students that are starting university now, particularly because of the transition year. I mean, I definitely think the transition year has made a huge difference in that students now tend to be that, you know, 18 at least. You know, the majority of students tend to be 18 starting college, and I think that that is beneficial. Mature students, like I know I went back to college myself as a mature student. There's definitely a lot of benefits in that. But at the same time, there can be negatives too. You know, a lot of mature students have added responsibility of, you know, having family and, you know, children to take care of, perhaps more aging parents, etc. So there's definitely pros and cons there. But I do get what you're saying about, you know, being that bit more mature. But, you know, a lot of college experience is about getting that maturity and getting that independence.
Many thanks to Fiona Flynn and Dr. Margaret McLafferty. For more, go to rte.ie/brainstorm, and you can find Brainstorm in all the usual social places. We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's episode, and subscribe to Brainstorm wherever you get your podcasts. My name is Ella McSweeney. Until next time.
Brainstorm is produced by Adrian Carty. Research was by Hazel O'Leary and recorded by Shane Dempsey at Collaborative Studios. For RTE Brainstorm, thanks to Jim Carroll, Aoife Ryan Christensen and Neil Lane. The RTE Brainstorm podcast is proudly supported by Research Ireland.